A customer is typically wondering, how big does your product produce value to them? And then the next question is, okay, it can produce value. How do you implement and integrate it going forward? And all those things require different experiments that you run and try to get bored and do things, right?
Welcome to the Leaders of B2B podcast, a weekly show where we bring you interviews and in-the-weeds expertise with today's B2B experts and thought leaders. You can see more about today's episode and guest by visiting our website at leadersofb2b.com.
Hey, leaders, welcome back. This is Ledge. Today, I'm talking to Sasha Kucharczyk. I know I'm not exactly nailing that, but we already had this discussion off mic that apparently everybody says his name wrong, including him. So, Sasha, welcome to the show. I would love to hear about you a little bit and also your company and the work that you're doing.
Great. Thank you for that introduction, Ledge, and it's great to be here today. So a bit about myself before I go into my company, Pretact. I am an engineer by training where I got into robotics, AI, early 2000s, thinking I was going to become an academic in that field, and then realized early in my career that academia is not my cup of tea. I like looking at things on shorter time horizons than what you would be seeing in higher end academia, where you're looking at 5-10 plus year time horizons to get results, or at least that's my perception of it, versus the business world, where you're looking at 1 to 3 years to get results and do stuff and iterate from there. And so I had a bit of a change when I was doing my studies of, hey, I thought I was going to do my PhD, go down that path. They're like, oh, how do I actually now pivot all this to go into the business world? And one of the things that really captivated me at the time, and this was, I want to say 26, 27, was I'd say the disruption of traditional Microsoft. And that is, you had the Zoom come out, which on a feature list was a very impressive product. And now a lot of people might not know what the Zoom is these days. It was Microsoft's response to the iPod, and it competed on feature lists, which you typically saw a lot of enterprise and B2B software being sold on versus usability. And one of the questions I had to ask myself at that time, and I was a very technical person at the time, is why did this product that on paper looked superior fail so drastically? And that ended up pushing myself to understand more about technology, not as a feature set, but technology as an experience. Technology as like a human-centered design, why people care and why people use products. And that led me into understanding a bit about product design, marketing, and really taking that technical hat I had in robotics, data, AI, and moving it in towards what is actually useful with. Like, how do you go through something that is commonly seen as overwhelming or scary and turn it into a beneficial experience to the user and an experience that they want to interact with? I ended up doing my MBA way and jumping into entrepreneurship. And through there, when I was graduating, there was a company or industry trend coming out in automotive called the connected vehicle. But at that time, the connected vehicle was, hey, let's give people a lot of data and let them figure out what it is. And the thing jumping out to me through all of this was, great, most people don't care just about data. They care about the actions and insights. How would this data make something useful to me? And that was one of the starting points of the company I helped co-found, Pretact, where we was looking at ways to help improve the maintenance experience as it comes to vehicle ownership. And so when we started it, we were looking at passenger vehicles, so personal vehicles going forward, and a perceived problem in the industry, and that is never seen as a great experience. When you had to get your vehicle in to do that, there were tensions going on between, can you trust the mechanic? The mechanic, on the other hand, has no idea what you actually need until you bring the vehicle in and does diagnostics. So as you can see from that, is you have a trust issue on one side and a service provider who, you know, pardon my language here, is a bit clueless on your needs until they can actually get a hand of your vehicle and try to understand what your needs are. And then you have to trust them because they're the expert getting the data and analyzing it, and you are generally clueless. So my thought was, one of my thoughts here and one of my team's thoughts was, how can you circumvent that problem? How can you empower people with the knowledge of the maintenance needs of the vehicles before they bring it in, but also help the dealership with that side of stuff so that you no longer have that problem with the data. Can you actually do something with that data being generated off the vehicle and the connected vehicle things to create a better maintenance experience? And so we experimented with that path a bit. And one of our early advisors for the company said, that's great for personal vehicles. People typically don't like paying subscription fees or something similar for their own car. People have tried it. You can look at, I think it was Mercedes that tried for the subscription for heated seats and quickly moved away from that. Why don't you talk to vehicles that operate on a P&L? Like a profit and loss statement, because they care about the dollars and maintenance is a big item there. But specifically, why don't you talk to bigger vehicles? They cost more, they care about maintenance, the revenue generating. Why don't you talk to trucking fleets? And we got a few introductions and we had a few bites in that side going forward and developed a MVP, helping with maintenance fleets with trucking fleets with the maintenance. And one of the people associated with trucking fleets was also associated with a municipal transit company in the area. So this was in Memphis. And the sale effectively was, trucks are $150,000. They keep them for 4 to 5 years before they flip. They're paying $15,000 to $20,000 a year in maintenance. Alternatively, you can talk to bus companies where they, you know, they might be about $1 million. They keep them 12 to 18 years and they're paying $35,000 to $40,000 a year in maintenance for them. It probably is a bit more attractive of a market to build an initial product when the underlying technology for the operations for the vehicles are the same. And so we started exploring the transit market and really started taking off there. There were a lot of hiccups going over because you're going from B2B, business to enterprise sales to government. And there's a lot of learning on that side, but also how the fleets operate, how you interact with the customer, how things go, how headcount's done, even how you talk about productivity gains. All those things were very different. And so there was a lot of learning experiences doing that. And we've been on a decent growth path right now in municipal transit for the last few years, helping them get ahead of reliability issues in the vehicles, help vehicles become safer while they're on the road and operating, reduce maintenance costs as well for the vehicle. So it's been a interesting experience for us, a great experience so far. We've been growing as a company. And I think the other great thing is most people either directly or indirectly interact with public transit. And so seeing ourselves produce a benefit for the public transit systems in North America is something that we personally feel as well, which is a nice experience to have.
You couldn't have imagined those pivots when you got it started at all. And I mean, I wonder, because people talk about this all the time, it's like, oh, I needed to pivot or I'm going to pivot. And I always wonder, I've gone through some of those things, but not such material length on an actual technical product. What's that like where you get up to that decision-making process and you just have to scrap or completely move away with what you were doing? Is it deflating? Is it encouraging? What's that like as the entrepreneur?
I'd say it depends on the situation. And so you have one situation going forward and doing it where unexpectedly you have a customer segment yelling at you for your product saying, we want this, give this, why aren't you doing this? And you might have one or two customers there. And it's just, you might be resistant because it wasn't what you initially thought you did. And you have to walk away a bit from your vision because your vision was wrong. But, you know, the customer is telling you, hey, I want this over here. And you listen to the customer. It's the end of the day. I both hate and love the phrase, the customer's always right. It's in the situation of some pivots, it's the customer's always right. If this one customer segment early on is saying, we really want this, give it to us, make it work. Listen to that customer segment, you know, grow with them, figure it out, build your business around it, and then go through other stuff. It might not be what you initially wanted or what you initially thought, but you can always go back to those other segments in the future when you're bigger or have more resources or have a more polished product out there, right? I guess on that side, you almost have to let your ego go out the door and just say, hey, I was wrong, but the customer is right. I'm here to serve the customer.
Yeah.
The other one that happens that I've seen is not as exhilarating. And that is, you have an economic crisis, let's call this one COVID, that essentially kills one of your customer markets as something viable. It's like, hey, they're now operating on a massive cash crunch with limited overhead and limited ability to spend or do anything. And it's like, even if you produce value, they might not see that value for a few months down the road, or there might be bigger projects that they need to go on and they don't have the excess people to work on new projects. Try as you may that you want to sell into them, it's not going to happen. And you have to figure out, how do you change that? How do you do things? And as much as you want to say an easy solution is produce more value for your customer, become like solve a bigger problem, it's not a real realistic solution, right? If you can just turn a light switch and solve a bigger pain for your customer, why weren't you doing that in the first place? It's not really an option that you can pursue. So you have to start looking at other segments, who else is biting, what else is going forward, and it might be, might not be as big, it might not be as sexy, it might not be as an attractive proposition to pursue, but it's better than not having customers.
Yeah, and I think about that first description that you had, I think implicit in that, or maybe not said, was if a customer segment or potential customer segment is the loud and squeaky one and build our thing, I would guess you're also evaluating at that point, what's the addressable market of this? Is this one loud, squeaky customer with that, if I build this, there's not enough market for other people?
So I'd say there's two things there that you said. One, make sure you are not building a service business, that you make building a product business. You're building a product that can work for multiple customers across the broadband, because it is that danger of you just, you know, customizing for a single customer, and you end up with something that's not really relevant for others. It's especially when you have a major customer early on, it is a trap that can easily be fallen into. And I've heard a lot of people fall into it. And we've danced around having that issue with one or two of our customers before of, hey, is this just relevant to them or is it relevant to the target customer base? And I think one of those things is making sure that what you are doing is relevant to others as well. But that doesn't address the first thing that you talked about, and that's targeted addressable market. And I have a hard time with this one because it really depends on who you talk to and why they care about stuff.
Absolutely. This is one of those weird, everybody talks about, what's your TAM? But it's just, hold on a second, that is the fluffiest topic because you can make up that number to make whatever you want.
But it's also how convincing and what is your storytelling, right? And I forget who talked about the wedge model for building a business. And it's, what is your initial wedge to get into that massive market? Who is that subsector of customers that are willing to buy? And then how do you grow? Because day one with any product you have, most likely everyone in the TAM that you're talking about probably is not a customer, right? It's, even if the technology is the same and could work, buying habits, using habits, integration habits, all those things are going to change customer to like in different segments. Right. And so you end up looking at what is that wedge you can go on and do it. And just because one segment is screaming more that we really want it, does not necessarily change your total TAM. It's just the initial wedge that you're going after. But then you have to address, how do you build on that wedge going outside and going to bigger? Like, how do you go from that customer to the next customer to the next to the next? What is that story? How do you make it convincing? How do you get those valid data points? Because if you're trying to create a story, if this is why we're relevant for this massive $10 billion market from day one, but we're only selling those ones, the amount of resources you're probably going to be wasting trying to get that market validation instead of building a product for the people paying today is probably going to be huge, right? You just focus on that wedge today, build that business, build that core. And then maybe get some validation of how you're going to horizontally just diversify other similar segments in that, and just how you're going to grow that pie over time.
Were you able to design the product solution in a way that was modular enough to apply to different use cases? Or did you actually have to rebuild a bunch of times?
So both. And I say both here, and it's like customer to customer, we have found, like customer type to customer type, we have found things relatively similar. And we are lucky that when you're looking at most heavy-duty vehicles, the manufacturers are similar. However, there will be some slight differences between manufacturers going in and slight differences between vehicle ages. And so there is some customization and change, and you might see different, you know, some different use cases going between and doing it. I think one of the biggest differences, somewhat addressing your comment there, is if you look at long-haul trucking versus municipal transit. Municipal transit vehicles operate all within the city. They will typically do maybe 40,000 miles per year on a well-operating bus. Long-haul trucking, you're looking at vehicles that operate between cities. between states, between countries, and they're operating over 100,000 miles per year, right? And right. then on top of that, you're also looking at engine age. A long-haul truck is 4 to 5 years usually before they send them off, and that's usually because of engine wear and tear, versus buses, you're looking at 12 to 18 years with the refurbishment there. And then you can also look at other contextual issues of acceleration patterns in the vehicles, right? Vehicles that do urban driving, brake and accelerate much more often than a vehicle on the highway. And yes, you know, the underlying technology core might be the same, but there are these like edge cases going forward that actually make what you would have as physical models actually need to account for other things to make the models relevant to the customer. And it's, right? So there is some changes.
Yeah, it's like the use case of the same models in different context, because all the other variables changed. It might be the same types of data that you suck out of it, but the inferences that you could draw from it all change based on the environmental factors of how it's being used.
Though. Yeah. And the problem might look the same, or like the failure state of the vehicle might look the same, but how you get to that failure state might change.
Interesting. Well, it makes me, this is interesting because I just, going back to your original supposition for the business, not the mass transit, but individual vehicles. Like I just had that experience where I go, I don't know, my engine light's on. I don't know anything about cars. How do I get, I know there's a computer in here somewhere. How do I get any useful information out of this to be an intelligent consumer? Yeah. And to my knowledge, you still can't do that. There's some plug under the dashboard and it goes to some magical place. And I really wish my phone could talk to that and just ChatGPT me the answer, but that can't happen. But maybe it will now that you can come all the way back around. Do you ever think of that? No. You could ever come back around to the original supposition?
So there are people working on that, maybe not with the ChatGPT side of stuff, but I do wonder, like, I wonder if I put up ChatGPT right now and plug in one of the codes that you would get if we give an answer. Actually, I'm going to try that right now. Just put up
live testing. But I can't even get the code. It's like just the missing interface of that thing, which was driving me crazy, because I'm sure that, you know, with internet access, you can find out exactly what they all mean. Yeah. So it's that user experience that is just wild that we have this stuff and we can't even access it.
So I actually just did this right now. So you can get the code. You can, there's dongles you can pull in. There's a lot of people that are actually building, lots of OEMs now are building the solution. But I actually just put in a common fault code that you'll see, a fault code is that come on. And there's like how to act on this code that comes up. And it's just, oh, this is the code. This is, these are the steps that you should be doing to fix that issue that is highlighted. Which makes me wonder, can something quickly be built on that side with just the ChatGPT integration? And the answer very much might be maybe.
Everybody needs to understand this is the engineer mind at work here. You give them a problem, they go right down the rabbit hole, which, and I totally didn't even set you up there. Okay, you're COO, like you're an executive at a company. You don't get to be a maker and in the weeds as much. How has that shift been for you to go from engineer seat to I got to get my MBA and then now I learned about business things? And I mean, this, it's almost two different sides of your brain in conflict, or is it in concert?
So I'm going to take a tangent from the question that you asked. And one of the things that I'd commonly see in conflict going forward is the marketing / design side or teams and the engineering teams, right? And one of them caring about usability and the other one caring about the technical side. And one of my personal beliefs, and this belief might be wrong, is I think it's useful for people to understand the other side. But when you have people doing a job, their job should be focused on the extreme of their job, right? I don't want the designers and the marketing people compromising with themselves when making decisions. They should be compromising with the engineering team to figure out what to do in doing it, as opposed to compromising with themselves before they go into that conversation, right? And, you know, bringing it back to what you talked about there of like in myself, and I'm the only person going forward and acting on stuff, right? We're not a massive company, so there's a lot of solo projects I work on. And I do somewhat have to compromise with myself going forward and doing it. But part of me is wondering is, would it be better if I had someone else to compromise with? Like I had, you know, I've fully baked in and thought about this one aspect on this side, and I want to represent what is best for this. And someone else's job is to represent what is best on this side. And then we actually have to talk it through to understand what is actually best, as opposed to, you know, in my head trying to do things or like making a pros cons list and going forward and all these things to make the best solution. If it's better to be useful to understand the other side, but not represent that other side when doing your own work.
Correct me if I'm wrong, you're an AI practitioner, but isn't that how a general adversarial network is trained? To each one gets better by challenging the other one?
There's a lot of ways to do like different trainings, and it's, I can't specifically comment on the general adversarial network. Like, I've just been like outside of the actual AI domain for too long. Yeah. But if you look at, I'm actually trying to think, I think it's reinforcement learning in doing stuff, right? It is. You're looking at the anticipation of future reward in doing things, right? And I could almost make an argument of the anticipated future reward of negotiating with yourself is less than negotiating with someone else where you come in optimizing something, like doing something, right? It's don't get yourself stuck in a local maximum as opposed to try the true maximum, because when two local maximum argue with each other because they're self-negotiated, you end up with something that probably won't represent the true maximum that you could get.
Do you get to execute this level of thinking in your business? Because it's fascinating watching you think, and I can know why you would have appealed to go academic and then saw the practicality of it at the same time. And it's just, it's interesting. How do you get to apply these thinkings to running a company?
Most of that stuff I'm actually doing when working with customers. As interesting as that stuff is to me on how you implement, why you implement, how you design stuff, and there's some organizational design and operational models that go through in doing that. But like with the customers, it goes to understanding their data, what it means, represents, how you design experiments to do stuff. Because a customer is typically wondering, how, like, does your product produce value to them? And then the next question is, okay, it can produce value. How do you implement and integrate it going forward? And all those things require different experiments that you run and try to get bored and do things, right? And it's, you know, what I can talk about going into those conversations with the customer is where we have seen a lot of success and what we think is optimal. And then the customer has to bring to the table what is possible on their side or what they can do or what resources that they have. And then you somewhat have to negotiate with them then of what is the best experiment to run and how do you do stuff, and recognizing as part of that the benefits and drawbacks of each experiment. And sometimes you try to be creative of running multiple experiments at the same time, trying to represent different things or to check with each other. And one of the issues that we have with our technology, and the output of our technology very simply is pinging to the customer saying, hey, you have this upcoming maintenance issue and this is how you should fix it. So one of the problems is if they act on it, you never know what would have happened, right? If they don't act on it and wait to see what would have happened, you lose anything of, okay, could they have acted on it? What would have that looked like? What would have the benefit been, right? And so no matter what experiment you run there, you're missing some very critical data for the customer. And so you start going through, okay, how do I run different experiments at the same time? And then you have these other things that, you know, two vehicles that look similar on paper probably won't operate the same way for the next deal. And one thing I've never actually figured out is what sample size is actually needed for what duration to get two things that represent normal, because like we've run experiments where it's 20 vehicles and one group 20 vehicles in another for a year, and they just operated completely differently. And they shouldn't, but that happens, right? So how do you run an experiment where your vehicles age and have different maintenance needs and you have weather conditions that impact how maintenance is done? So you might not be able to trust historical data and, you know, as a good base. And then you don't have a great control group going forward and doing that. And you'd trying to limit the resources needed to run the pilots, you can't just say, oh yes, let's just do 200 buses versus 200 buses in a controlled experiment for 3 years. Because then they might just say, it's like, why don't we just push the technology? Oh, because we only have 400 buses. And I'm like, oh, that's a great idea. That doesn't happen though. It's going forward, like, how do you create an experiment that is good enough that you have multiple sources of information that might be able to check for the biases or issues in the other data and give them the information that they want so that they can make an informed decision and justify that informed decision.
You have like unlimited attack surface for problems that could impact your results. Anything of how are the city roads? What condition are they in? What about weather patterns? Are they salting the roads? Are they taking them off the roads in the south because they don't even drive in the snow? It's endless.
Yeah. So you mentioned weather right now, and this winter versus last winter, completely different pretty much all through North America. The whole Northeast has been exceptionally warm. The southern states have gotten a lot of snow. And if you're trying to look year over year, given that weather conditions have an impact on maintenance, right? You really can't. In the Northeast, they're probably going to have operated much better. And this winter is just going to look better on the maintenance side than the previous winter because it's less cold weather-related issues. Now, if you look in the South, it's probably going to look much better or much worse because you have all these cold weather issues going forward, and they probably didn't prepare for it either. Right. And so it's how do you account for that? And how do you say, it's cold weather. You should add X factor to the results to account for that skew. But can you trust that? Like, those numbers, they might be data justified, but still, they might just seem made up.
It's striking. This is such a good analogy for doing business at all. Just like endless variables and virtually nothing you can control. Yep. What have you learned working in? You just have complete chaos that you can actually gather a lot of data about. Yep. Most people have complete chaos that they don't have any good data. And you get like gut choices or best guesses. But what have you learned about that you can abstract? I think that's so valuable for anybody running a business.
I'd say there's at least three different things. And I think probably the biggest one that overcomes almost all obstacles is get someone who is senior enough in your customer who is just a champion or hero for your product and what you're doing. Like just emotionally loves what you're doing, has a buy-in, is willing to speak out and do things. Like if you have that person, barriers just erode, right? It's that person is the reason why you exist. Almost nothing else really matters at that customer. Maybe one day you'll be called out on ROI or doing something, but you're assuming if this person loves you that much, they probably have done something. Maybe you're walking into
it. It's like a champion evangelist. Yes. You must have your champion evangelist.
Yeah. So I think that's probably the biggest one. The second one I would say is know what data matters to your customer. They all have KPIs they operate on, they get measured on, they look on and do. And know what they are, how you impact that and play into it. Right? As you mentioned, there might be a million different things that you can show and do. They probably really only care about 3 to 5 different things that they're tracked on and going forward. And unless you have a massive value outside of those going forward and doing it, let it be by the wayside. Focus on the big things, focus on the things that they care about, and hopefully you get a great sell out of it. And the final thing is target a big enough problem that 80%, given that there's going to be error on it, solves a big enough pain for the customer that they're willing to pay a price that makes your company economically viable. As difficult as it is to just execute on and solve a bigger problem, one of the things is if you solve something that is big enough, they're not going to look at the nickels and dimes of, are you actually solving? Is it worthwhile? They'll be like, yes, it's obvious. It's going forward. It's doing it. Gets through all the resistance. And then you don't need to also spend, you know, all this time and all this detail trying to justify your price point or, you know, your value to the customer. It's like, yes, it's big enough. It's good, right? It can show your customer like a 5 to 10x ROI on doing something going forward. You know, they're going to be a lot less resistant than showing a 2x ROI. Like they might be like looking at the nickels and dimes going forward. Is it actually there? Let's get into the details. So solving a bigger problem allows you to do less to show value and makes the customer more comfortable that things are going to produce value for them.
What problems have you solved for customers or your customer segments that you didn't even know existed? Because I see that happen a lot. Like in fact, because of that customer interaction, you discover new problems and that you actually have part of that solution for them and you didn't even know it was there when you got into the market.
Yeah, that is a very good question. I'm actually trying to think on that side of what like unknown problems that we have solved for the customer in doing that. And you know, part of that is actually how we, like, I don't know if it's a new problem we've solved for the customer, but the way that we have solved the problem. And it's, oh, what are we actually looking at in the data to build models for them to help them understand upcoming maintenance issues? And it's all sometimes say, oh, do you account for this in your models and how you forecast things? It's, oh, we never actually thought of that or thought of that relationship or gone through. And building that out and incorporating that sometimes helps produce great results. I know there's been some experiments we've done on the side with different things. It's like one thing that we never really thought was a huge problem until we really got our hands dirty is coolant issues on buses. It just happens if you look at the data. Buses have a lot of coolant issues, like coolant leaks, issues in the coolant system that can cause a lot of on-the-road issues or other things. And you know, you have situations with some fleets where if your coolant's low, your coolant system's not working, it can lead to the engine overheating, which those engines, 1,000+, they're very protected of them. So they will have thresholds in there, even at the whiff of an early issue, essentially force the vehicle to shut down or create a flag to bring it in. Because they'd rather deal with the $1,000 to $2,000 tow than deal with that massive maintenance event. And so there's some things in there that we just didn't expect when working with the customer. Oh, that minor issue ended up being very major. And it was just like, we never expected that. Like, how can you build something around to help them? And yeah, how do you handle that situation? Yeah, and a few just different areas of the vehicle looking at where they say, hey, it would be great if you could build a model for this or incorporate this, or how do you do that? The other thing that we had that ended up having value for some of our customers and going forward is essentially internal tools that we built to understand the data. And so we have a set of tools that we have built for our internal team to understand the data that's coming off the vehicles, what's significant, what's not. And some of the customers that we've worked with have, you know, asked for access to that. Because, you know, for them, you know, they're like, yeah, even if your product doesn't cover that area of the vehicle or does stuff, it would be good for having that tool to help us understand what's happening too.
And this just gets into a little bit of technology. So I'm just curious, how does data get from a bus to wherever cloud or whatever thing you're doing to process all that data?
I mean, it's really no different than a cell phone these days. It's you have a device that plugs into the bus that reads the data on its communication bus. And like that communication bus will just have all the sensor data going back and forth between the different computers on the vehicle. And so you just read that data as it goes across there. And then you either have a cellular connection that streams that data off, or like when it goes back to a base station or a depot, it offloads the data collected and then it gets sent off after. It's actually a very simplistic system. Most vehicles, almost every vehicle for the last decade and a half will have something that can be accessed to collect the data, and you just need to provide a tool to send it off.
And you're able then to, your software solution would then just take all this data that you know is in some kind of engine computer format and turn it into insights just based on processing it?
Effectively. I mean, we do, the way that we train our algorithms, we do leverage human expertise as well, essentially field expertise to understand what's happening and help with the labels. But it's just, you get the data come off, you run it through different analyses going forward. The data format is generally standardized. It's all, you know, governed by, at least in North America, by the SAE. So there's, you know, standardized formats to go forward and do that. There's a bit of a battle going on that side with the right to repair laws and access and who can access it, what it looks like, how does that look like. But for the main part, most vehicles have easy access to the data. It's all on a most of it's on a standardized format. There's some proprietary stuff in there that's not part of the standardized format. And then you just get the data coming off and you analyze it.
Right. Okay, you've got a business and you've got your experience running it. And are you where you thought you would be right now? Or what have your lessons been in growing up into this sort of, wow, I run a company and it turned into something? And like, how does that fit overall in your picture? I'm always interested if people set out with a goal in mind or took advantage of little opportunities when they saw them. My own journey is, if I told you what I planned on 20 years ago, it's laughable because I'm not there at all. So I love the journey picture of how you got where you are.
So 20 years ago, definitely no idea I'd be here. 10 years ago, probably no idea doing stuff. So that was like 10 years ago was when I was finishing up my MBA. To be honest, I did not know what I wanted to do 5 years out when I was doing my MBA. So maybe venture was calling to me a bit. But like even when I started it, there was a problem that interested me. But I do wonder if like, the other thing that really interested me is, hey, it is a frontier area at that time. So this was like 2014, 2015. Using data to intelligently build products that solve real problems. And like, to me, that was an area that was still booming, but was starting to boom at that time. And I feel like I was partially called to do, let's get some real good experience doing this and firsthand experience. And, you know, the fact that it turned into something is awesome. But I don't know if that's what I was really thinking of at the early stage. I thought it was more of a item towards career progression than an actual, hey, I am doing this because I want to be building this for the next 20 years. And I don't know, like, I wanted to build a product. I found it really interesting. The fact that I've worked with a team that has built a product and it's doing well is great. I don't think 10 years ago, I would have been like, if you thought, where do you think you'd be in 10 years? I might have that maybe exited and either doing another company or working in some type of innovation or VC role or doing maybe another company, who knows what. I really do think I came into this as a learning experience and I've learned a lot. I think just now it's like where I think things will be for the next 5-10 years. I think next 5 years is a lot of growth opportunity in doing stuff, but there's so many different ways things can go, right? It's
right.
You know, I'd love for the company to be 10 times the size in 5 years in terms of success and doing stuff. Yeah, we grow stuff, we get stuff, we had a real impact. The company's name is known in the industry. I think all that stuff would be awesome to talk about and to accomplish. But where will actually be? I don't know.
Right. That's okay. I'll call you back for another episode in 5 years. We'll just see. I'm thinking about doing that. I'm coming up on long enough in between the early interviews and the later interviews, I'd be like, okay, here's all the things you said 3 years ago. Let's do a check on that. So I love it. That's thank you for sharing the journey. One thing I like to ask founders and sort of leaders in whatever position you're in, what do you do that's not the business to keep yourself engaged and wanting to show up at your own company every day? I've had both experiences. I remember one company I started, just I didn't even want to get out of bed in the morning. Like I hated my own business. And the other ones I've been excited about. And I just wonder like how you keep that energy going for yourself when it is years later and it's a lot of work.
So it's not just, it is a lot of work. It is years later. And you both have positive and negative momentum, right? Like you look at any meme as it comes to founder mentality and it's a roller coaster, right? And it is. You have your highs and your lows. Right. I think when you're on the upswings, it's so much easier, right? Like you're chasing positive momentum and you're doing stuff. I think on the downswings, survival instinct takes over. It is, hey, you know what? It needs to get done. This is what needs to happen. You're just, you know, survival, right? It's just, that's what drives you. It's like, this is what's needed. You're doing stuff and you're acting away. You're somewhat the bad side is you might be a bit tunnel visioned on survival. The issue I find is, okay, you survived, you're at that low, it's going forward. How do you get yourself out of that, right? And that, I admit, I don't always have a great answer to that. And I do, you know, taking, like, being able to walk away and clear your mind can help. Finding things that allow you to feel meaningful can be useful. Like, for me, I sometimes find doing small projects on the side not related to the company where I feel like I accomplished something that could be meaningful in the long term can be great. And just do something. Hey, it takes you 4 hours to do stuff. But at the end of the day, it's like, hey, I've did something. And start trying to build that positive momentum back, right? And it's start moving on. Like, how do you switch yourself out of that, okay, survival, we survived and whatnot, back into that positive trend of building and going forward and doing it? Because it's not a light switch. It takes effort, it takes energy, and it can be painful to get back and do things. And vacation can sometimes help, or just stepping away and doing that, but you have to be careful, is work on your mind, right? And you have to find a place where if you're trying to get out of a funk at work, that work isn't the thing in the back of your head.
Yeah, I love that. You know, essentially building momentum in a different space to translate it back to just ride that in a different context. So I think that's right. You reminded me of that. I just make up projects in my yard and I go move a bunch of rocks or build a little wall or anything that I can look at it and I can go, I have accomplished something. And it moved from point A to point B in a distinct period of time, because you don't get that validation sometimes from a long-term business strategy. I'm moving 1% every day. I'm not moving and making anything like that right now made a difference.
I'm going to tie that back into a comment I made earlier, why I got out of my academic path. It is being more attracted to those short-term wins and shorter-term wins than the extremely long-term wins.
Absolutely. Before I let you go, my final question is always, okay, there's a future state and it's coming and there's a lot of information out there. And what I try to think of is, what do you recommend or think should be on every B2B leader's radar screen? Like your unique experience and perspectives, it led you where you are. What should people be tracking right now in whatever role they're in? Like what's really important going forward the next couple of years?
So I think one of the most important things for people to probably understand right now, like as a business leader, is the value of AI, right? And you have all these things coming out over the last 6 to 12 months related to ChatGPT and all of that, all these productivity tools, all these gains, all these useful things. But one of the problems is how do these tools actually translate to benefit for your business? But not just any benefit, but specifically cash benefit for your business. Right. And you'll have theoretical benefit and then you'll have like accounting benefit going forward to doing it. But at the end of the day, buying a tool, integrating, implementing, what you really care about is the cash flow difference. Right. And either are you going to be producing more and getting more revenue coming in? Are you going to be cutting costs and doing something? Like at the end of the day, you have to really be seeing, what is that cash benefit? In knowing what it is. And I feel like you're going to hit an AI bust soonish. And by soonish, I don't know if that's 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, who knows, where people have adopted all these new sexy tools. And then they're just like, but how is my business actually benefiting from this? Right. And, they end up with this cost bloat and then they end up cutting all these costs because they invested in it, but they're not really seeing anything. Right. And focusing on, great, you're telling me it can have benefit, but how do I actually unlock that for my company? And what does that mean in terms of either cash in or less cash out? And then spending the time to understand that before really adopting a technology.
Which is exactly the same story we should have done for any new technology. Yeah. You just can't slap it on and go, oh, yay, AI made me what? Like it doesn't matter.
I 100% agree with you. It's true with any technology you're implementing. I just fear that with AI, because it seems like obvious productivity gains, right? And so it's like, great, you have ChatGPT, you save times and do things, right? But how does that actually turn into a benefit for your business? Oh, it might just be you send better emails going forward, so you piss off less people with less distractions, so you have less headaches. But yes, it might be an employee benefit for doing that or doing things, but if you're actually looking at an ROI for the business, unless you can actually capture that in terms of custom employee retention or less lawsuits or something, is it actually going to justify its own value in terms of maintaining that cost? Right? Or will it just end up being a novelty?
Which takes you exactly right to the spot of saying, let's evaluate the potential ways that we could experiment with this. What things should we have baselined before we did it so we know if it got better at all? And I think there's a lot of implementation without experimentation that is going on. I couldn't agree with you more. I bought all the tools just because I'm a big nerd and I use it on a regular basis, but I also can't look at it and say, this generated me more money yet. Yeah. And it's helping me do things that I wasn't going to do anyway. Therefore, is it really saving anything? I'm just not sure yet. And I would encourage every business leader not to turn on $35 a seat for every single add-on for every tool that you use, because I'm not sure that auto-generating a title on your video is going to make any difference to your business.
Yeah. So be careful. All the doing stuff, like you have it, it's replacing people taking notes, and people might not like taking notes, right. But it doesn't actually end up translating into something significant.
Right. So now a computer knows all your things that you're not going to look at instead of a person knowing all the things that you're not going to look at.
A person would have known it anyways because they were listening, right?
Yeah, great point. I appreciate that. I stand with you on the practicality measure. Fantastic. Well, Sasha, thank you for the insights. I really enjoyed the conversation. If anybody is resonating and wants to connect with you, wants to connect with the company, what are the best ways to do that?
The best way to do that is to connect with me over email or LinkedIn. My LinkedIn is just Sasha Kucharczyk. You can send me a message. Email, you can send me a message at Sasha, S-A-S-H-A, at pretext.com, pretext.com.
Fantastic. Thank you again for coming out. Love the conversation. Have a great day.
Thank you, Ledge. I hope you have a great day, too.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Leaders of B2B podcast. And as always, you can see more information about this episode and all the resources mentioned at leadersofb2b.com. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a 5-star rating. This episode is brought to you by Content Allies. We help B2B companies launch revenue-generating podcasts. We schedule interviews between you and your ideal prospects and strategic partners. You show up for engaging conversations. We handle everything else. Ready to build a podcast that grows your business in just 1 hour per week? Reach out to us at contentallies.com.